This is Car Expert.
43,990 drive away is an absolutely amazing price for an electric vehicle. So I'd be very curious to see how this goes.
Everything about this car is cool. The price is not so cool.
Cars can bite you very quickly at the limit, and most people haven't experienced that. So it's good to build up to that limit.
Hello, my name is Mandy Turner. This week I'm joined by Tony Crawford.
Hey, Mandy, how are you?
Very well. And William Stopford.
Hey, Mandy.
Now, Crawf, I don't know how often you've spoken about this. Can I come on the podcast and talk about the 911 Turbo S run under the airport? Okay. Fill us in. What is the story about this?
Right. So I get a call about 2 weeks before this event from the Porsche guy, Chris Jordan, who I've done some amazing trips with, last one being the Speedster in Italy. So let's not go there because it was too much fun. And he says, look, I've got something for you, because our boys, Chris had moved up north to the Sunshine Coast because of COVID, and was running events out of Brisbane. Of course, good old mate, our boys, who's not even a Porsche owner, got everything but a Porsche, gets these great, GT3 track stuff and all this sort of thing. And so, mate, have you got anything for down here? And he said, I do have something. I'll let you know next week. Calls me up and says, hey, how would you like to drive a Turbo S on Sydney Airport, flat out? And I said, well, that might be something I'm interested in. So anyway, look, it was in like days, really. And over 4 months, they'd somehow managed to negotiate the use of left 16, right 34 runway at Sydney Airport. And it's a 2.2-metre stretch of tarmac, and it's a very wide stretch of tarmac. It's hugely wide, and I'll talk about that in a minute because it's actually quite disconcerting. And we're driving the Turbo S. So this is a review like no other. You get two runs. We had a 0 to 400 launch, and then we had a crack at 0 to 300. And that was the goal that everyone was gearing up towards. And you had to put the anchors on proper and turn right off the track at a certain point. So you couldn't just keep going. Yes, I got 302. Not weirdly. Obviously, there were reasons why we couldn't have cameras both in the car and we had a pro driver in the passenger seat. So I'm not sure why he couldn't have held a mobile phone, for instance, to record it. But anyway, it was professionally recorded with an outside camera. But we weren't allowed any cameras, so you had to rely on the co-driver looking at your instrument display, which I did. So 302. But let me just walk you through the start. So it's quite a process that you have to remember to launch the Porsche, even though the process is actually simple. But we were told to hit the boost button. So you picture at the line, it's a very wide track. It's, it's hundreds of feet wide, essentially. And you basically foot hard on the brake, press the boost button inside the driver mode display, then accelerator flat to the floor, let go. That's it. And you've got to do that really quickly in sequence, because that boost button goes for about 20 seconds. So 20 seconds goes pretty quick. So you've got to do that, and then you launch the car. Well, I tell you what, the only reference I have is launching the Bugatti Veyron back in 2008 in France. And that actually, I don't think, got off the line to 60 or 40 as quick as this Turbo S did, because my vision went blurry for about a split second, because it was just an assault on the mind. You didn't have time. The brain had to catch up. It was just so fast. And then time slowed down at about 255, because it seemed to take a long time to get from 255 to 302.
Was it manual?
It was paddles. PDK, yeah. And, we just left it in. So back in the launch, I was in Sport Plus because that's the most aggressive. But in this particular mode, we had a running start at about 20Ks, and I'm in Sport mode. The reason is because it reduces the amount of aero, so the drag, which is why we got over 300 and hit 302. I think if you'd left it, and that was probably just after a kilometre, by the way, so don't forget, this is a 2.2 stretch. So had we wrapped it out, we probably would have got well and truly the 330 top speed, which is pretty fast. But 302 is really fast. But, yeah, it was really disconcerting to keep the car straight for a second because that wide runway, we didn't really have a line to follow down there. So you can imagine how difficult it is. You just don't have reference points.
How did you go with braking?
Oh, well, basically at the point where you needed to brake, just basically come off the throttle and don't hammer it as you would on a racetrack. It was quite a gentle brake, and then we sort of got more into it when we needed to make that right-hand turn off the runway and back around to come around to the start point again, you know. Yeah. But just amazing car, and, you know, I don't know. I've driven – the last time I drove a Turbo S was Kyalami in South Africa, the famous old racetrack, Grand Prix track. And that car, I tell you, was actually catching the GT3 as it would on the straights, like in a heartbeat. It was quite amazing. With a pro driver in it, we were catching him in the Turbo S. And, you know, even though it's about 200 kilos heavier than a GT3 RS, the car is incredibly good around corners. You don't actually feel the weight because it's, you know, that all-wheel grip, that all-wheel steer. It's just amazing, you know. It's the one car I want to buy eventually. I need that. I need a Turbo S because basically you can – I mean, I've seen videos. We didn't get the chance to do this, but I've seen YouTube videos where people are launching that thing 50 times in a row and there's no warnings coming up on the screen, you know, heat or whatever. It just keeps doing it. And I think that's testament to the engineering that goes in the 911 in particular. Anyway, look, that was just a once-in-a-lifetime event that probably won't happen, and we can thank COVID for that. But and for Porsche to organise such, I think other car companies, I had messages from mates of PRs of other sports car brands, and they were just saying, good on Porsche for organising that. So innovative, you know.
I think it's probably every motoring enthusiast's dream is to take a supercar on an airport strip, and you've done just that, Croft. So you're a very lucky man.
I've only ever done that in Grand Theft Auto.
Yeah, well, I guess if we – yeah, I mean, it's something they are apparently doing it. They were leasing that track out to other – or that runway out to other people as well. So it was interesting. You know, very innovative from both Porsche and, I guess, Sydney Airport to actually, you know, even though that we had the camera restrictions, you wouldn't turn it down for all the tea in China, right?
To start off with this week's car news, it is over to you first, Will. South Australia is planning an EV levy. What is all this about?
Yeah, so they've put the proposal forward as part of the 2020 to 21 state budget. So what they're suggesting is charging people who drive electric vehicles a fixed fee, similar to the way you would charge for, say, rego. And then beyond that, a variable charge based on the distance travelled, which puts the South Australian government in a very unique position in that they are effectively disincentivising electric vehicle ownership, which is very unusual because as we've seen in other markets, there are heavy incentives. You know, you go over to the US, for example, and the federal government will give thousands of dollars in tax credits if you purchase an EV.
So must be the only country in the world that doesn't actually provide incentives.
Yeah, exactly, because we effectively don't. That is exactly right. I think here we've got, from memory, fuel-efficient vehicles like EVs attract a little bit less luxury car tax, and some states and territories will, you know, waive or reduce the stamp duty, but there's not that kind of large incentive for EV take-up. So naturally, this proposal, which might not even make its way through, it's been slammed by the EV Council, well, naturally. It's been slammed by the Federal Chamber of Automotive Industries. It's been slammed by manufacturers of EVs like Hyundai. And my favorite quote was from Behar Jafari from the EV Council, who said this. I just had to laugh when I heard this. Unless every government in the world is missing something obvious that the state treasurer uniquely understands, the treasurer may want to re-examine the logic that brought him to this point.
I agree, because they've just announced, it was on the news this morning, in fact, all over the news, that Australia was going to be the recipient of some quite severe weather from here on in, a direct result of global warming. And to think a government of any nation that would sort of enact something like that, and rather than the incentives that even London has of no charge going into the city in your car and all that sort of stuff. I mean, it beggars belief to how stupid some of these people must be.
Exactly. And look, I vaguely understand where they're coming from in that, well, we can't tax somebody who owns an EV for fuel because they're not paying for any fuel. So these people need to pay up some money if they're going to be using our roads. But it is so unbelievably short-sighted, because already EVs are considerably more expensive than a comparable petrol or diesel car. So they're already at a disadvantage. There's virtually no government incentives for you to actually buy an EV. So they're already on the back foot there, as we can see by their absolutely minuscule market share they have compared to Norway.
But Will, they're paying for electricity.
Yeah, I know, exactly. So that's why I think this is absolutely ridiculous. Now, the South Australian government isn't completely ass backwards when it comes to EV take up, because they were proposing rolling out a network of charging stations throughout the state. That was a statewide charging network, and they were suggesting that they would be buying more electric vehicles for their fleet. But I mean, that's one thing. But to actually effectively disincentivize electric vehicles by slapping on an extra tax on there is just absolutely absurd. And funnily enough, after all of the controversy about that, in the news today, New South Wales, it was reported that New South Wales is considering following South Australia down that electric vehicle rabbit hole. So
anything for a dollar.
Yes, exactly. So it is very frustrating, and it is very short-sighted.
Croft, would this stop you from buying an EV?
Potentially, because I thought that was the whole point of reducing emissions, was to get everyone trying to drive electric vehicles. And I tell you what, New South Wales is pretty backwards. I just find it deplorable that our state government bus fleets that run around local suburbs at 4:30, 5 a.m. in the morning, making a god-awful noise with their diesel engines. Why we don't have those running on electric battery power? Because, I mean, if there ever was a vehicle suited for batteries in the floor, it would be, you know, a 60-foot-odd government bus. 30-meter government bus. I don't understand it. Someone needs to. I'm missing something too, obviously. I just think it's amazing that we don't have government fleets running on electric power.
Yeah.
You know. But in answer to your question, without any incentives alone, and the fact that Will correctly said that electric vehicles are normally command a premium of between 15% and 30% on their petrol or diesel equivalents. Why should you be penalised for helping the environment? I don't understand it. You know.
Very, very true. If you've got any thoughts on this topic, please email us, podcast@carexpert.com.au. Hey, Croft, while you're here, the 2021 BMW iX has been unveiled, a brand new SUV for the brand. What do you think of it?
I just sort of saw this today on our site, carexpert.com.au, and I've been thinking the M4 and M3 cars that we've seen on the site look a bit like a walrus, but I'm really in love with this thing, and there's probably no surprise, because I really love the i3. I thought that was one of the coolest I still think it's one of the coolest vehicles, and three or four times in the last few years, I've toyed with buying one of those, albeit secondhand. I saw this recently on the site, and I'm loving this design, guys. And the fact that it's actually coming here in the second half of 2021 to compete with Audi's e-tron and Beamer's EQC, I think I'd be already heading towards this thing. And wow. I think the exterior not only looks great, but that interior is stunning. Mm. I'm a big fan of this new BMW. I've grown to love this BMW. It's not going away, put it that way. So it's no good thinking they're going to change it in the near future.
The grill, you mean?
No, yeah, the grill. Yep. They're not going to change that. That's here to stay. But I think the way they've, at least on the photo that we've got on the news article, the lead pic of that black surround of the grill with that sort of really quite elaborate grill material inside that grill is tremendous looking. Yeah, I love it. It's funny. I was really against it. Now I'm loving this. I think I like the fact that it's a full EV with a really good range. What is it? 600K range, and that interior with that massive 14.5 inch screen, beautiful. And the steering wheel looks amazing. And I noticed they've created the interior space to look like, you know, a beautiful sort of furniture store, if you like. And that's exactly, I mean, this is even nicer than the sort of Scandinavian look. It's got that sort of next level. To me, it looks like if Bentley were going to do an EV, this is what a Bentley would look like.
Yeah, interesting comment. I think I haven't been a fan of the big grill of BMW, but it's funny. I think it looks good on the iX because it's a much higher car than the likes of the M4, true, and it suits it a little bit better. I like the little nod to the i3 down near the D pillar, that little bit of horizontal black plastic.
Oh yeah,
that's also there. But the rest of it, I'm not liking. But the interior, ooh, I think, is the best feature of the car. What do you reckon, Will?
Look, I've got strong opinions about BMW design language. All you have to do is just go around different Facebook groups and see people sharing the same meme of like BMW grill getting bigger until the grill is the whole car. I'm frankly sick of seeing that meme. But you know what? The X7, I love it. 7 Series, love it. I think the big grills really work there. The M3 and M4, when I first saw that, I thought, oh, that's a bit much. But now that I've actually, you know, seen more photos of it, I like it. But this, I'm hoping this grows on me. I think my concern with BMW's design language at the moment is, you know, we all made a big song and dance about Chris Bangle when he really started dramatically changing design language of BMWs in the early mid-2000s. But it felt what he was doing was very original. It was very fresh. And all of these new BMW designs just feel like a bit of a retread in some ways. Like if you just look at this iX, you've got the giant grill that we've already seen, you know, very similar versions of. Originally, the grill was actually going to be even bolder because if you look at the iNext concept that this was based on, the double kidney grill was kind of like, it was more connected. So the design boss said during development, oh no, let's separate that. You know, we've gotten a little bit of feedback here. The double kidney grills need to be not conjoined. But it's when you look at the rest of the car, it kind of does. You say a nod to the i3. I say it pays heavy homage to the i3, and it just doesn't feel terribly original. That said, two things I will say that I really like about it. One, that it's actually going to be on a bespoke platform is very interesting. Now, BMW has announced that they're going to be rolling out electric versions of everything from the 4 to the 7, all points in between. But they're going to use the same platform architecture for petrol, for diesel, for plug-in, for electric, etc. Across all those model ranges. But this iX, I always call it iNext again, will actually, from what I understand, will actually have its own bespoke platform, which is sensible because I know the i3 was quite popular in Europe, but I can't imagine it was very profitable being a more kind of inexpensive electric vehicle.
The i3?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not
saying it was very expensive. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. So it wouldn't have been terribly profitable for BMW, whereas this will likely be more profitable. The second thing I will say about this as well, that interior is nice.
It's gorgeous.
It's so good, right?
Yeah, love it.
Yeah, a steering wheel's like something you'd use on a video game.
Oh yeah,
reminds me of an Austin Allegro, which I'm sure BMW doesn't want to invite that comparison.
another polarizing design. But it let's hope this is. Oh, well, look, the Allegro sold a decent amount in the UK. So I was about to say, let's hope this is more successful. But let's hope this is better received overall.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, that's true. Sticking with EV news, Australia's most affordable all-electric car is here, and it's from a brand that might take you by surprise, MG. The car is called ZS-EV and is priced at $43,990 drive away. It's just under $10,000 cheaper than the Hyundai Ioniq Electric Elite, which is the next cheapest one you can get. So what's even more surprising is it's $3,000 cheaper than the pre-order price announced earlier in the year for the ZS-EV. Now, range in this is acclaimed 263 km from a 44.5 kilowatt hour lithium-ion battery pack. The power comes from a front-mounted electric motor with 105 kilowatts and 353 newton-metres. MG isn't stopping here with the ZS-EV either. It's got plans to roll out the larger SUV, the HS plug-in hybrid, soon as well. So buying an EV, I suppose, has never been more achievable for someone looking in the new car market. Do you think MG has set a precedent now for other manufacturers to follow with similar pricing with these guys?
Oh, it's very interesting. It's definitely shaken up the market there because, as you said, it not only undercuts the Kona, but it's more direct rival. Oh, sorry, the Ioniq, but it's more direct rival. The Kona is more expensive still. Now we've actually got a review up of this. Our Kurt Dupre down in Sydney went to the launch review and to the launch day for it, and he was quite impressed with how it performed. And in particular, he had a lot of positive things to say about the ride and handling. So it is a very, very, very sharp price. I'm very curious to see how this kind of stimulates the EV market and how it's received overall. One interesting thing about it, though, which I will point out. So MG's released a very heavily overhauled version of the ZS, called the ZST, which adds a lot of active safety technology and an upgraded interior, et cetera. But this ZS-EV actually keeps the look of the cheaper ZS that's carrying alongside. Now, if that sounds insane to you, Chinese automakers do this all the time. They'll often run like kind of concurrent generations of things alongside. I think at the moment, if you go to China, Dongfeng Hyundai sells like four different generations of Elantra at the same time. So go figure. But wow. $43,990 drive away is an absolutely amazing price for an electric vehicle. So I'd be very curious to see how this goes.
Can I just say, though, that I mean, I've read that it actually has halogen headlights.
Yeah.
I mean, for an electric vehicle to, I mean, it just doesn't even compute in terms of being modern and contemporary. And I mean, halogen lights, I thought they were virtually dead and buried.
Yeah.
Back five years ago, at least. I don't know. I mean, I presume the Kona. In fact, I'm certain the Kona has LEDs.
A lot of companies make weird choices like that, though, because from memory, the Mitsubishi ASX, there's like LED headlights are standard across the range, but if you step up to the Eclipse Cross, LED headlights are only standard in the top spec model. So, but I absolutely agree. Like that's just one really small detail that you think they might have sweated.
That's true. The Nissan Leaf is only, I mean, it is more expensive at $49,990, but the new Nissan Leaf and the latest iteration of it actually looks quite good. I saw it the other day, certainly from the rear angle, and I assume that gets a bunch of modern kit inside, although I can't be sure because I haven't driven that car. But do you know, anyone else know about the current Leaf?
I've not had a chance to drive it yet.
No.
Have you seen it?
Yeah, it's a
current one. Yeah, certainly been modernized to when the original Leaf came out.
Well, yeah,
which was a really poor thing for like $50,000, wasn't it?
Yeah,
just a bit over this, but yeah. Look, I agree with what you say. If any manufacturer, which is also a challenger brand, can start, and that's what challenger brands need to do, right? They need to shake up the market with some very innovative and good priced options, don't they? In the market. It seems like MG is doing that.
Yeah. At the very least, this will do better than, say, the Renault Zoe, which Renault was just discontinued, which was one that was like $50,000, and that was a hatchback. And if people are spending that much money, even if it's an EV, they want something with a little bit of space. I think this will do well, considering how ZSs are flying out the freaking doors.
Yeah,
I think this stands a good chance.
Yeah,
yeah. The range is okay, do you think? 263.
Yeah. At the end of the day, you're going to have the same arguments from people who are not into EVs. That whole, oh, but I might drive up to Cairns. Yeah, okay, cool. Great.
Yeah.
Great. But how often will you do that? How long is your daily commute anyway? Where are you driving? Are there not EV chargers? And then you get into the people making arguments about, oh, well, I don't want to stand around waiting for 40 minutes at a charging station. Well, if you're going on a long road trip that one time a year that you probably do it, then you're going to be doing other things while you've stopped at a rest stop other than charging.
Yeah.
So, look, there's always going to be people that are going to scratch their heads and furrow their brows at the idea of an EV. But I think the best way to appeal to buyers out there is slap a low price tag on it and $43,990 drive away. That's pretty good.
It's pretty good, right? Yeah. Yeah.
Well, exactly. All right. And I think it's been an EV news week this week. Will the 2021 Lexus UX 300e has been confirmed for an Australian launch and it's coming next year.
Yes, it is. So this will be Lexus's first battery electric vehicle that they're selling. So, coming around November next year is the word that we've gotten. They've quoted an electric range of up to 400 kilometres. That's on the older NEDC test cycle. Under the WLTP, with the stricter WLTP standard, I believe it's like just over 300 kilometres. So, yeah, pretty like decent range. It's based on the regular UX. So I see this as being kind of a transition model for Lexus. I don't know, maybe it might stick around for another generation. But if you look at what Toyota's plans are for electric vehicles overall, they've got, for the Toyota brand alone, they've got 6 different electric vehicles coming that they're aiming to introduce by 2025 that will be on the new ETNGA architecture. So there's no way in hell that that's just going to be reserved for Toyota. Lexus will almost definitely get their hands on that EV platform for their models as well, considering how, you know, that they use Toyota platforms generally. Anyway, but this UX 300e, it's got an electric motor on the front axle, so that produces 150 kilowatts of power and 300 newton meters of torque. Lexus says that it can be fast charged in under 50 minutes or in 7 hours via a conventional AC socket. Now, Lexus has done so well with hybrids, including in Europe, where obviously Lexus is far behind Audi and BMW and Mercedes in market share, but they've carved out a little bit of a niche over the years by offering hybrids. So it's very interesting to see them finally get into the electric vehicle market. And they have chosen one of their more popular models and one of their more affordable models to enter this kind of new era with. So I'd be very curious to see how that goes as well.
I heard a figure the other day that the electric vehicle sales amount in Australia to, is it even a percent? Is it actually under a percent? It's incredibly minute compared to the overall share of all other brands, all other segments of vehicles. When do you think we'll get to the point where people actually buy 30%, 40% of EVs? Is that soon, or is it a decade away, or is it 5 years away?
The government's going to have to step in, like governments elsewhere in the world have done, and start actually incentivizing them. Because a lot of people, you know, they obviously don't want to pollute the environment. They don't want to be driving around in cars that cost them an arm and a leg and fuel and produce a lot of emissions. But at the end of the day, we're all, you know, people that have budgets. So we don't want to be spending an absolutely exorbitant amount on an electric vehicle. So you've got to kind of sweeten the pot to get people to actually buy them and get to that eventual price parity. And we're nowhere near there yet. And the government really needs to start thinking about that.
It's also got to be convenient, Will and Mandy. You can't have it that it's got to be in the too hard basket or people just, you know, reject it.
Yeah, look, where I live at the moment, I couldn't have an EV. I live in an apartment complex, which is fairly new, but it doesn't have any kind of facilities in the parking structure for EV charging. Now, I know a lot of newer developments do, but there are still a lot of Australians that live in older apartment complexes or who don't have access to off-street parking, and EV ownership is years away for them. But there's a lot of people right now who, you know, live in a home that have a garage with charging outlets, with power plugs, who might even have solar power at their house. And for them, particularly those people that don't actually have that long of a commute, they're just driving in from the suburbs to their office or warehouse or factory or whatever.
Yeah.
EV ownership would be great. The problem is they're not buying EVs because they're too bloody expensive. So...
Yeah, I agree. I've got Marek. I really hate to say this because Marek will listen to this podcast, no doubt. But I want that. I want that Tesla truck. I badly. Like I need to have that truck.
Cybertruck.
Yeah, I've got to have one.
God. You know, look, a lot of cars grow on me after I see them more and more. I think the Cybertruck is the opposite. When I first saw photos, I'm like, yeah, that's pretty cool. I like that. And the more I see photos of it, I'm like, no, that's. That's ugly. It's gross. I mean, that new Rivian truck, that interests me a little bit
more.
The GM3V.
Yeah, I saw that several years ago at, I think, the LA Auto Show. And I saw both the ute and the SUV in pretty much look like production form to me. And I was blown away by the quality of the build and the innovation within the car itself. Like they had a in the Ute they had a spot for surfboards alone that you could just slide in. I mean, I thought that was so cool.
Car experts, resident track performance reviewer, and World Rally Championship driver Chris Atko Atkinson. It is a pleasure to have you back on the podcast.
Great to be back with you guys as well.
How are you, Atko? Good.
Very good, mate. Good to hear from you as well.
Yeah. Good now, to be here because they've left me out, Atko. I'm sure they do it on purpose.
You're not that unforgettable, are you?
they reckon I talk too much. But, yeah.
I hadn't heard that.
Atko, this time we aren't here to talk about one of your track reviews, but we would like to talk about tips for your first day racing at a track. Do you remember much about your first circuit track day on tarmac?
I have no memory at all. I do remember my first rally experience, and the best thing that happened there is I went along and there was an expert there and I had someone to learn from. And I think that's probably your top tip, that going where you can learn from someone who's better than you, who can guide you, and you're open to thoughts. And that's what I remember probably from my first rally experience, which was with Rick Bates, who's a well-known rally driver. He's brother Neil Bates is multiple Australian champion. So having someone like that there to guide you through the process is probably one of the key points.
Was he in the car with you, Atko?
He was actually.
Yeah, so that's the best way, isn't it?
That was brave of him because I don't like sitting with other people. So it is good. And I think people need to – the second point that I had, and most people I come across do have this in mind, is you've got to be cautious when you go there. You got to take it step by step. Don't go flat out in the first corner and throw your car off the road and have a terrible experience. Just build the pace up and be guided by people. Don't go there thinking I know everything, because cars can bite you, as we all know, very quickly at the limit, and most people haven't experienced that. So it's good to build up to that limit.
So, Atko, for someone who has never raced before, what sort of car would you recommend them to buy?
I actually get asked this question a lot, and it's not as easy as it sounds. My main thing, and it always seems to loop back around to safety, because it is a dangerous sport, is buy something with the right equipment in it, with a cage if you can get something like that, with the harnesses, get everything checked. So something, it doesn't have to be amazing. Like my first race car, my first rally car, well, it wasn't even mine. It was my brother's. I borrowed it and crashed it. But don't worry about that. It was like $6,000. So it's not like you need to spend a fortune, but it had a roll cage. It had harnesses. It had everything like that in it. And it was completely safe in that that respect. And it was good fun. It was rear-wheel drive, Toyota Corolla. You could slide it around, have fun, and learn the limits of yourself and the track and cars and tyres at not a high speed, and then build up from there. And the crazy thing is, like, you go to these track days now, and you even see what I'm driving. Some of these cars are doing times as quick as proper race cars with no cage in it. And I am a little bit hesitant against that, because I've had my fair share of big crashes. And it does happen when you're pushing the limit. Things can go wrong. So safety would be my first thing. Things like these Toyota 86 series, things like that, something that's built and prepared for the track, not crazy fast straight away, and learn to push the limits of that car before going up into something that's like super fast, because a lot of these supercars are quicker in a straight line than an actual V8 supercar or something like that. They are ridiculously fast on track and can do times on road tires that blow your mind.
Pretty impressed, Atco, with this new Toyota Yaris GR Rally Edition coming out.
Yeah, that looks exciting, really exciting. And it's cool to see Toyota grabbing a hold of that motorsport, that rally tradition, and putting it into the road market, which is cool, like Subaru used to do, like Mitsubishi used to do. It's good to see Hyundai and now Toyota putting some of that thought into their road cars, which is exciting. It gives us something exciting to go out and drive.
Yeah.
Which sort of segment in motorsport would you recommend for a beginner outcome? Because obviously you've got competitive racing, and then you've got the likes of regularity. Which do you think is probably the best to start off with?
I think a variety of stuff. I think doing things from little autocrosses, learning some car control, then just to – I know they do them up here at QR, and I'm sure it's all over the country, that there's so many actual opportunities to go and just spend an hour or so on track and just explore that before going into full racing. Because it is a big commitment to go get a car, like fully caged, everything like that. You want to explore it a little bit before you go and fully commit to something. And there are a lot of opportunities through either car clubs or, like I said, Queensland Raceway. Definitely do it up here. They have a lot of days where it's sort of open sessions, helmets on, and everyone just going out and exploring. And they say there are actually very few issues and incidents because everyone is respectful of themselves and things like that. So go out and just do a few laps, see if that's what you enjoy, and learn car control, learn like exploring your limits in a safe way. Like I said, the autocrosses are great as well. Sliding around, learning to deal with a car that's out of control, and then learning the technique of obviously racing as well. I think you need to get a variety of situations under your belt and build that experience before just throwing yourself into a race series.
What about just even a skid pan, Atco? Like, grabbing a skid pan for a couple of hours and
I think that can be really good. Just teaching that car control. You're probably not going to use it very often on the track, as you know, but it's that odd moment that it gets away from you that you know what you're going to do. And it's funny, we're so taught in Australia that's bad to learn to slide the car and stuff. Like where you go to Scandinavia and they grow up learning to slide the car. And then they can deal with it if it goes wrong or if there's a bit of ice or something like that. Where in Australia, we're told you just don't go fast, don't do anything wrong, and then you'll be fine. But you have no idea what happens on the other side when it actually does go wrong. So,
I'm actually shocked with Australians going to Germany and getting on an Autobahn and sitting at 160 Ks when they've never been more than 110.
Oh, it's scary. It's scary. And if the car starts to slide or aquaplane or something like that, they'll just panic. They have no – the best thing you do is stay calm, and the first thing they'll do is panic. And it's because we're just not allowed to have that sort of
fun
or risk-taking or realize what the limit is. And you see people just – I just watch people go into corners on a daily basis and they have no idea what the consequences are, like even on the roundabouts near my house here. And you see them go through the street signs every week as soon as it rains because, I didn't expect that to understeer. Well, of course it's going to understeer. It's wet. It's greasy. There's been no rain for a while. And people don't know this. The more we can get people out exploring the limits, like I said, skid pans, autocrosses, they don't need to be super expensive cars, like I said, and just go out and have some fun. But obviously with still the safety in mind of building that up, build it up over lap after lap after lap in a safe environment, and then you'll find the limit, but you don't go straight there. You just don't go flat out into turn one and hope for the best. You've got to build that limit up.
Mm-hmm. Echo, obviously apart from the outlay of buying a car, what are some of the other hidden costs that people don't really consider going into motorsport?
For me, I would obviously consider things like you need to look at insurance as well while you're on track, things like that. Tires, racing licenses, things definitely add up in motorsport. Throwing sets of tires every weekend isn't cheap. If you take your road car there, and I think a lot of people get surprised when they'll take a supercar and all of a sudden they get a $40,000 bill after a couple of track days, because you got brakes to worry about. You get some of these supercars, like the, I don't know what the brake packages, and cost 20, 30 grand to replace the brake, the discs and the pads, things like that. So I always look to go maybe more towards a car that is more track focused, something that's already built to do that or has been engineered in that way, because you'd be surprised how hard it is on cars' components just lap after lap at the limit. Most road cars aren't designed for that, and you've got to bear that in mind. If you're going to go track your road car, you've got to think about, okay, we're going to go through tires and brakes regularly, and you've got to be willing to confront that cost, and that's where finding a package that is a bit more reliable, a bit more consistent, it's going to make your experience that much more enjoyable, because every time you go out, you're going to spend $2,000 or $3,000 throwing tires and brakes at a car, then you're going to be a little bit annoyed after a while. So you've got to think that through.
Yeah. Atco, I remember the day when our boys and I used to go up to Morgan Park. Whenever I'd go up there, the number of GT3s, And the guys would come in and we'd talk to them, and they'd say they change the brakes once a year. It was unbelievable how little maintenance they did, and they did a track day every month basically, whereas the guy that rolled in his GTR Nissan, he was up for a fortune, he said.
Yeah, and I'd agree with that, and that's why, like in that GT3 RS I drove recently, like, there's not many better track options than that. It is designed to be there. That's what Porsche expect you to do. You know, they expect those cars to be tracked, and they're engineered that way that they're going to last a lot longer, where some cars say they'll perform that well, but like you say, then they, as soon as you push them on the track, you just need to start throwing parts, and then you need a warehouse out the back full of parts. Yeah. So it is a rare car that's capable of doing multiple laps at the limit.
What about something like an MX-5 for, you know, a second-hand MX-5, that sort of thing?
I think that's a great option. I'm in a strange situation because I've been driving other people's cars for 20 years, so I come from a point where I get all the new bits all the time, and I probably have no idea what it costs. I think the thing like a car like that is MX-5 is light, and you look at the Lotuses, like Albor's Lotus, things like that. Anything that's lighter is just going to be so much better for wear and tear, better on the brakes, better on the tires. So things like that, I 100% agree. I actually drove the MX-5 the other day and had an absolute ball in it. I didn't think I was going to, and I was there. Like, it actually had a handbrake that worked. I could do handbrake turns. Like, this is awesome. So something that's fun, and you don't need, like, I had just as much fun in that as you can have in a Ferrari, basically, you know, because it's the joy and the engagement. Like, you don't need to be, like, you go there into turn one at 200 and something k an hour in a Ferrari, and you're like, I am on the limit, and I'm like, there's a skill to that, but there's also a stress to that, where in the MX-5 I could just send it in there, and if it slid a little bit, I wasn't even worried. So you want something that's sort of quite raw and basic, manual, brake pedal was just nice and firm and stable. Everything was not over engineered. It was just engineered to work And I'd agree with that. Same with the Lotus when I drove Albor's Lotus. Definitely wasn't the fastest car on the track, but it was fun and it was a challenge, and it wasn't slow, but it wasn't crazy, and you could just enjoy your day. You could go and do 100 laps and enjoy that and walk away without a huge bill.
Just before you go, Atco, the latest track review that you have up at carexpert.com.au is the GT3 RS. How did you find that bashing around a track in?
I think like most people, I had an amazing time. Like that's a almost perfect track car, and just you can sort of keep exploring the limits with that. I had four laps to go into a time, so it's sort of a bit different. It would have been nice to be there all day and work away at it, but I said, okay, four laps. And on every lap I improved in that car just because it is not easy to drive. I think the GT4 Cayman, which I drove earlier in the year, was I could go straight to the limit on that and found it a bit easier to drive, where this is still it starts to be a proper car. It's pointy. I was blown away by how quickly and how well it turned, the way the rear differential was working and things like that. Only differential, I'm used to having three. So it was just it just rotated so quick. It was very pointy like a race car. And the thing I struggle the most with is that it's so fast. I had in my mind when I get out of the corner, I felt like I was actually in a race car on slick tires, but I wasn't. So I would almost be over optimistic into the next corner because the car is so capable laterally that when I jumped on the brakes, because you're still on the inside then of a road tire, you just lack the braking performance. But engine was superb. For a naturally aspirated engine, and I started to think about this more and more as I write these stories, is that for a track car, and especially two-wheel drive, whether it's front-wheel drive or rear-wheel drive, NA engines are just that much more enjoyable. You're not having to manage the torque of the turbo cars that we were always looking for traction. You can actually drive them quite hard and aggressive, and comes back to that MX-5, things like that that just engage you a little bit more. When you go turbo, it's nice to have that all-wheel drive traction because you got torque from such a low area, where the GT3 RS, just that engine just sings and is just great fun.
The more you're talking about that, and then back to the MX-5, you'd wonder why Mazda doesn't come out with like a club sport version that's set up to do track days. Like, why wouldn't you do that? I would have thought there'd be a big uptake in that.
I think so completely. Like, I had no idea going into that test what that car would be like, and I came away, like I said, I was coming down the main straight and pulling the handbrake and doing donuts and going away and having an absolute ball in the thing. It's actually like a car was, you know, 20 something years ago, in terms of that you actually drive it. It doesn't do everything for you. I find some of these other cars, like, you come off the throttle and jump on the brake and the brake does more than you want, and it's all assisted and controlled. On a track, you want to be in control. You can make the car fast with all these electronics and all these aids, but I think for the average person to go to the track, the best thing they can have is no assistance. You know, learn the limit of the car, learn the throttle control, learn the braking control and the release. That's where all the skill is. Otherwise, the car's just doing it all for you, and it's no fun. It's no challenge. It's, well, you go and do a hobby because you want to challenge yourself, and it'd be the same as going to the track, and that's what those raw sort of natural cars give you.
I 100% agree. It's actually one of my most favorite sports cars. Chris Atkinson, we thank you so much for your time. It was a real fascinating insight.
My pleasure. Good to catch up with everyone.
For this week's car review, Crawf, you're talking about the Peugeot 2008. How did you find your time behind the wheel?
Well, I've got to go back a little bit because back in the days, the early days of our previous business, we loved when the 2008 came in, the previous generation came in, everyone in the office, and that's both journos and management and other people, everyone wanted to take the 2008 home because it was, not only was it this small practical SUV, but it was also a really good car to drive in that it gave you some feedback around the corners. You could really tuck into a corner and it was really well balanced. And so then that was around for ages, and then it sort of died away, the popularity of it. I don't know whether the car was ever that popular with Australian buyers. French cars always have a little bit of a difficult time in the last decade or so in selling. But what they do give you, they give you a fairly sort of, you know, cutting edge design. And that's what this new 2021 2008 certainly delivered. And I think everyone on the launch, we drove it for not a long time, maybe a couple of hours in total in Sydney. we all love the design, and the build quality certainly looked like it was well and truly up on previous Peugeots, so that was good. Mm. The interior was a cutting-edge design.
It's beautiful.
And it had sort of, it's got a 3D instrument display, so you get sort of a forward vision of important things like speed, and if you got directions or whatever, they're behind. So I really like that. It also had a very large infotainment screen in the center of the car, which I liked. However, there are a couple of howevers. The steering wheel, which I love because it's a real sporty, small diameter, almost elliptical wheel. It's sort of two flat bottoms, flat bottom top, flat bottom on the bottom, sorry, flat top. And it's the way they've got it set up is if you actually want to see the instrument display, you've got to have the wheel in your lap. It's so bizarre. It's really quite bizarre. Everyone had the same issue, and it's been that way forever, you know, in the last decade or so anyway, that you've got to really adjust this wheel. So I had it sort of above my lap, obviously, and so I could see through the under the top of the rim through to the actual speed. It's a bit weird, but I like the steering wheel. Like I'd almost sacrifice the fact that I can just see the speed and nothing else. But look, you just got to adjust the thing yourself and get it right for your own height and stature. And then you seem to, I mean, and even the, I'm just looking at the gear selector on my review on Car Expert, and I'm just thinking back how nice that felt. It's like an aircraft controller. It was really quite cool. Everything about this car is cool. The price is not so cool. I think they're going to struggle with the price of this vehicle. It's a light SUV, so it competes with newfound models like the Skoda Kamiq, which I really like as well, and that's quite a bit cheaper. I mean, it's not like this thing doesn't get a kit. It's got a fair bit of kit. Their base version is called the Allure, and it's $34,990 before on road. So we're probably talking about a $35,000 car here, and the top shelf GT Sports price at around $43,990 before on road. So they're not cheap. It's quite a bit of money. I think the Kamiq is like the top end Kamiq, I think, is around, oh, I was going to say, you know, 34. And that comes with a lot of stuff. That's the 110 TSI Monte Carlo. So, look, it's got a lot of competition. I think it is one of the better looking, if not the most contemporary looking light SUVs out there. And light SUVs don't amount to, I think it's about a, I was going to say like a 4% share of the total car buying market in Australia. Will probably correct me if I'm wrong on that. It's not a lot, but it is. I see it's growing because there's a lot more exciting cars coming out, like this 208, like the Skoda Kamiq. And Mazda are in there. I mean, everyone's got the Volkswagen T-Cross. That tops out at $30,000 before on roads, and you've got the Hyundai Venue. They're all pretty cool cars. The Mazda CX-3 Akari, the top end model, is $35,990. So, look, I think there's nothing wrong with the Peugeot 208, but I think pricing is up there with sort of small, sort of expensive small SUVs. So I'm not sure how they're going to. I'd love to see this car do well, because it is a very, very nice car when you think of if you don't want a large SUV and you want, or you don't even want a medium and you want a light car, this has got plenty of room. What do you guys think of it?
Look, I think this is where the French often face a hurdle, because you were talking about, for example, the steering wheel, and it's a very, very unusual kind of steering wheel and steering position and gauge cluster position for a car in this class. And I think French either, they go quirky and they play to their kind of strengths in that area, but then that backfires because people, if they even manage to get to a Peugeot showroom, because I don't know, you know, Peugeot's got a bigger presence here than Citroën, for example. But yeah. Still, I don't know if Peugeot is necessarily on a lot of people's shopping lists. But if they go into the showroom and they find that they can't get a normal, quote-unquote, steering position and seating position, then they get turned off by that. But the flip side of that is sometimes the French go a little bit too conventional and conservative. If we look back at cars in the past, like, I mean, off the top of my head, like the Citroën Zara, then there's nothing to really, the Zara was a perfectly fine car, don't get me wrong, but there's not that much to actually get people into the showroom and to get people driving out of the showroom because they're battling against the whole, oh, well, why would you buy a Citroën? Why would you buy a Peugeot? Why would you buy something more sensible that has a larger dealership network that might be cheaper to service? Now, I will say Peugeot's design language at the moment is one of the most stunning design languages of any mainstream.
Yeah, right. I totally
agree. Yeah.
Absolutely 100%.
We all gorgeous, love it, right?
Gorgeous inside and out. But Peugeot right now has this amazing range of gorgeous cars, but they've got a battle that years and years of this perception that French cars don't really belong on your shopping list or just don't stand out enough to get on your shopping list in the first place. Mm-hmm. So that's the hurdle they've got to battle here. And I think that pricing is a little bit ambitious because I'm sure, you know, it's quite well specified even in the base level. However, before Onroads, you're looking at about, what, $7,000 or $8,000 more than a base T-Cross or a base Duke. Now, if the French really want to get more of a hold on the market, I think they're going to have to offer lower prices to just get people in the door to begin with.
I agree. It's a pity they didn't start out with that. And I don't know whether it's a fact that it's in shape. It's not the factory doing business here. It's through a distributor. And obviously they have to make a profit and you know, everyone's got to win. So that could be part of it. But look, on the plus side, you know, Peugeot's come with 5-year unlimited K warranty, 5 years of roadside assist and 5 years of cap price servicing. So, you know, there is, you can have a bit of confidence in buying a Peugeot these days with that sort of service and warranty aspect.
And I mean, it still undercuts, say, luxury brands. But the problem is when you look at some Peugeot price tags, they're getting a little bit premium. And the thing is, this is a mainstream small SUV or light SUV.
SUV, particularly. Yeah. It's even in a different segment, but it's priced with, fairly high spec Konas, which is in the small SUV category. But look, I'm sort of going back on my review and, you know, that top spec does get Nappa leather. I mean, you don't really find Nappa leather in light SUVs ever. I think you get value for money. It's just not what people want to pay for a light SUV, probably. I might be wrong, but look, there are plenty of people out there that are quirky and do want something different from the norm, and that's how companies like Peugeot, Citroën, even Skoda for that matter. Skoda are becoming a little bit more mainstream now, I'm a big fan of all these challenger brands because they have to work really hard to win customers, you know?
And we have to consider as well just how lucky we are to live in Australia, which has the most ridiculously saturated new car market.
I don't think the French get these cars at all. I don't think the Americans get these cars at all.
They don't. They haven't had Peugeot since the early 90s. They haven't had Citroën's officially sold there since like the 70s. Alfa Romeo only recently got back there. So if you look at markets, often we look over at the US and we're like, oh, no, I wish we could get a Challenger here. I wish we could get a Cadillac here. But then they're looking at us saying, oh, my God, what Peugeots? We want them.
Well, yeah, can I just say one of the outstanding aspects of driving this vehicle is not just the fact that it had a really good chassis, but it was the actual ride comfort, particularly in the cheaper Allure running on the 17-inch wheels rather than the 18s. The ride comfort was quite extraordinary over some broken road. You just didn't feel it.
That's a French for you. That's something that's right, that's always right. held near and dear. And that is, look, that's a unique selling point that French cars can offer, a really comfortable ride. So maybe if that was included in their marketing, wink, wink, that would be another reason to get people to actually go to showrooms and consider them.
I don't think there'd be few, if any, light SUVs that would ride as well as this did on the 17. And the 18s was quite fine too, just a little bit sharper, that's all.
And it's funny that we're talking about this 2008 because it's just the strangest case of like Bader-Meinhof phenomenon, but I keep seeing the 4008 around here in Brisbane. Remember that? The back before they developed their own crossovers, they just rebadged a couple of Mitsubishis. And I keep seeing 4008s here. And I'm like, I never see Peugeots up here in Brisbane. Two, why do I keep seeing these? They didn't even sell that many of them, but they're like stalking me.
Yeah, the tech is, like you said, Mandy, the tech is lovely. It's actually so futuristic. I mean, it's just two screens. That's it. There's nothing else up there. It's quite nice, yeah. And I think to do that 3D instrument display, it's really innovative. And you've got to give it to brands that are innovative like this in a world of an homogenized world, if you like, you know.
Totally agree. You can search Peugeot 2008 at carexpert.com.au. And that's an end to this week's podcast. Any good reads up at carexpert.com.au, Croft?
Oh, look, Mandy, I don't even know if this is a concept, but it says it's a concept. Audi RS6 GTO concept unveiled. Please, without even properly knowing anything about this vehicle, can you please build this Audi? I will buy one.
I agree.
And, of course, that Rivian, I've got to know more about the Rivian because after seeing it in LA all those years ago, and now it's finally actually, you know, in production and being sold. Let's hope we can get that eventually. Yeah.
Fingers crossed. Nice. That's one EV startup I'm really keeping my eye on.
Yeah, absolutely.
What cars have we got in the garage next week, Will?
Well, look, things in Victoria seem to be almost back to normal. So there's quite a few in our garage down there. So we've got a new Ford Escape, the base model. Looks like we've got the updated Hyundai i30 hatch in top spec N-Line Premium. There's an Audi RS5, a few Toyotas, including a Hilux Rogue and a RAV4, because, you know, people can't get enough of the RAV4, so we've got a review on. In Sydney, it looks like we've got a Range Rover Evoque that's going through the garage down there. Now, up here in Brisbane, I'm driving an MG ZST, and Alborz is driving one of the most beautiful Japanese cars of all time, the Lexus LC500. So I will be drooling over that.
Wow. Yes. Yeah, that's a pretty special car, that LC, isn't it?
Mm. Yeah, special is definitely the right word. Tony Crawford and William Stopford, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mandy. Thank you, Will. Great as always.
Thanks, guys.